You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sustainability is a word that's often used nowadays, but what does it really mean, and what does it take to be truly sustainable? John Ehrenfeld, who's been a specialist in the field for over 20 years, has written a book in which he discusses his work and suggests new ways to move beyond what he says are our half-hearted attempts. Sustainability by Design, a Subversive Strategy for Transforming Our Consumer Culture, is published by Yale University Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought John Ehrenfeld to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
You say the current sustainability strategies are just Band-Aids. Why don't corporate social responsibility or eco-efficiency work?
Well, they do, but they're really solving the wrong problem. They're reducing the unsustainability. They're looking at areas which we clearly think are bad, are getting worse, and it's like any kind of cut. You put a Band-Aid on it, but if it's serious enough, you better go to the doctor to find out why and get something done about it.
But aren't they seen as a start?
Absolutely. I say nowhere in my book or ever that one shouldn't do these. My argument
is... You mean put in the fluorescent bulbs and build windmills
absolutely.
And put solar panels on the roof?
Right. We certainly want to slow down this Titanic we're on. The iceberg's still ahead of us. So anything we can do to slow it down gives us more time to begin to address the problem at its roots.
And you say there are bigger issues that these quick fixes miss.
I think the quick fixes miss the root causes. And it's not that they're bigger issues. I think that they in the name of sustainable development, aren't really producing what I would call sustainability.
But you go so far as to say that these quick fixes could be detrimental to the process of becoming sustainable.
Absolutely. Just the way alcohol is a quick fix for somebody's stresses becomes extraordinarily detrimental to the body. The use of Band-Aids as the only way we tend to solve our individual and social problems is, in a sense, addictive. Or if not addictive, it's certainly defocusing in the sense of turning us away from where the root causes might be.
On your blog, you've drawn parallels between what's happening on Wall Street and fixing unsustainability with these Band-Aids. How do you see them as related?
Somebody actually does read the blog. It's a new blog, and it's a sort of surprise. That article focused on one aspect of the book, and that is the way that I talk about nature and the world as a complex system. A system that we can't really describe. We don't know the rules. And when you get into that situation, Band-Aids don't work. It's kind of arrogant to think they do, and that's where a lot of our troubles come. So that article on the blog suggested that we should sort of bite our lip and take some small steps. Clearly needs to be worked on, just like the unsustainability of the world needs to be worked on. But accept that what you think are the solutions may not be the solutions. Go slowly. Spend a lot of time learning as you go and be adaptable.
Well, how does sustainable development and sustainability differ?
Well, sustainable development is defined as a better way of economic development, doing as I think you mentioned eco-efficiency in your trailer. It's giving us the same kind of values with less impact. It's an improvement. But it doesn't change the fundamental way we think about the world and the fundamental way we act.
And so when I've had other people on, experts on global warming, and ask them whether we can reverse global warming, they say, well, not with what we're doing,
right,
even if these things are effective in a way.
That's right. They will certainly slow it down and maybe cap global carbon dioxide at some level, but we aren't going to ever maybe return to the levels we were 100 years ago.
Well, do you think it's possible for humans to flourish on the planet forever? I mean, many species have died out. Why should we assume humans will be spared, especially since we've done so much to endanger our species through the abuse of the planet?
Well, I really can't answer that question, but this is this whole book and what I've been certainly working toward, if, you know, forever is more a metaphor, it's at least trying to keep us around for a reasonable length of time.
Well, how would you define sustainability then?
I define sustainability exactly as that, as the possibility that humans and other life will flourish on the planet forever. And forever is really a part of that that gives it a sort of as a timelessness. But it's not forever in the sense that I'm counting years up to the billions.
My guest is John R. Ehrenfeld, whose book, Sustainability by Design, A Subversive Strategy for Transforming Our Consumer Culture, is published by Yale University Press. What is what you call the Tao of sustainability?
Well, one of the I look at a lot of, I look just like I talked about alcoholism as an addiction. I look at the culture today as addictive. Cultures, in my way of thinking, are a collection of habits. That's good because habits are what make the world work for individuals and for societies. But when those habits start to produce side effects or unintended consequences, and I think unsustainability is just one of those, you really have to look at why and how do you change the habits.
Well, if consumption is an addiction, how do we deal with that? Isn't consumption necessary?
Absolutely. But the kind of a consumption that characterizes our society is more harmful in many ways than it's doing good.
Well, planned obsolescence came about during the Great Depression to increase consumption as a way to support the economy.
Right.
And often when we talk about doing things to combat global warming, critics say, well, you know, it's going to have a negative effect on the economy.
Well, it may. It very well may.
People in the Northwest don't want us to stop them from cutting down old trees. People don't want to close down the local power plant because it's providing jobs.
Absolutely. But as long as you equate flourishing with GDP or some economic measure, then we're kind of in an endless loop. You've got to have more. But if you begin to look for flourishing in a different sense, as a systems output, as a whole, in the same sense we see beauty in masterpieces, then we can uncouple this. And if the GDP doesn't grow, maybe that's not going to be the same as a growth in what it means to flourish, what it means to be human, what it means to take care of the world.
We've said that nothing man-made is eco-friendly, so we're in some kind of trap, aren't we?
I think so. And certainly this book is an attempt on my part to try to understand how we got in that trap and how we can really sort of get ourselves, lift ourselves out of that trap.
The book is called Sustainability by Design. What role does design play in creating sustainability? Isn't design an aesthetic concept?
No. Design is the construction of something new to solve a problem that's become refractory, that's become difficult, that doesn't work, that the older methods don't work anymore. I see design as more than simply fashion, as aesthetic.
So what kinds of changes do you envision for our system and our culture before the goal of sustainability can be achieved?
Well, in a societal sense, going back to the comment about the connection between Wall Street and sustainability, I think we need to begin to inject a bit of precaution. It's a principle that's taken hold in Europe. It just simply says when we deal with issues we can't describe in laws, where science really has done as much as it can and it still leaves us in the dark, you act with precaution. You do things You have to act. This is not saying we stop. But you begin to accept that maybe what you're doing isn't going to turn out the way you expect. And you build an adaptive system, a system that's watchful, a system that is built on learning as you go, not on the learning that the professors brought in from the past.
Well, going back to Wall Street, government has had to jump in because the problem has gotten so out of control. And although there's disagreement of what government's role should be, ultimately it's going to play a role in that transformation. What role should government play in the transformation to sustainability?
Well, I think in changing the decision processes we use as a rule. We build them on some kind of rationality, on cost benefit. Most of the, at least the regulatory decisions, are made by law on what's the most benefit for the least cost. Begin to replace that with a structure that has precautionary principle built in.
But looking at what's happened in this economic crisis, we waited until the situation was pretty far along and we were faced with serious crisis.
Right.
I suspect, just knowing what I know about the way things work in this country, that we have to have a situation where somebody is saying, well, everybody's going to die within 2 years if we don't do something, and then the government will be motivated.
Right. Well, that's the subtitle of the book, is a subversive strategy. I think that's all too true, as you just said. And I think it's very hard to do big things until crises come. So the model here is to use the very technology that's sort of an addiction, the technology we consume, and begin to build in, through design, new values and new strategies.
So you got to give people a sense of new values, or at least get them to a point where they recognize that they need to change their values.
They need to wake up. You don't really learn a lot in life unless you begin to reflect. Reflection's a key element in the recovery from addiction. You have to acknowledge you're an addict. You have to then face that. That's a form of reflection. So the example I use in the book of design and technology is a device that you find all over Europe, but rarely in the U.S., and it's called the two-button toilet. And it's a button with two flush buttons. It's a toilet with two flush buttons, a big one and a little one. And it's obvious what it's going to do.
So if we use less water with the small button than
right.
we do with the big button.
But the user has to stop and think and make a conscious choice. And it's in this moment of awakening, of presencing, and accepting your role in it, that you begin to embody a new set of values, a new set of responsibilities. Flushing, saving water becomes something that's mine. It becomes a new value I have.
My guest is John R. Ehrenfeld, who was with the MIT Center for Technology Policy and Industrial Development and the Departments of Chemical Engineering and Civil and Environmental Engineering at MIT. Now he serves as Executive Director of the International Society for Industrial Ecology and is Senior Research Scholar for the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. In 1999, he became the first recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the World Resources Institute. He's written a book called Sustainability by Design, A Subversive Strategy for Transforming Our Consumer Culture, published by Yale University Press. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with John R. Ehrenfeld. His book, Sustainability by Design, is published by Yale University Press. I want to go back to a question I asked you earlier. I'm not sure I understood the answer. You said that in the book that nothing man-made is eco-friendly. Now, not only what do you mean by that, but how do we get around the fact that if we're making things that are everything we make is eco-friendly, how do we get around? Wind up doing something different?
Well, that's a comment that's made to counter basically the advertising of objects that are advertised as eco-friendly.
You mean the soaps that I've been buying these days that cost 10 times as much as the commercial soap?
One soap might be eco-friendlier, comparatively better in terms of some specific impact on the environment. But I just I take exception to the term eco-friendly, not comparative, but as some kind of absolute way of describing the product.
Everything so you're saying it's destructive on some level, just less destructive than
right.
the other
and
stuff.
And that's fine to compare yourself. Advertising has done that forever, that my product is less harmful to the environment.
Use this fluorescent bulb because right. it's less harmful
than
an incandescent bulb.
But to say it's friendly is, I think, sending the wrong message.
So businesses have to play a major role in this, not just in developing new things, but also in not sending out the wrong kinds of messages.
Absolutely. I mean, business is a fact. Many people who write about sustainability take on businesses as the enemy, as the villain. I share some of those notions, but I also look at business as the most dominant institution in the world. So business kind of has to take on a role in dealing with sustainability.
Well, I'm sure there are some businesses that see this as the future, a way to make money. Until we convince them that they can make money, they're not going to do anything. For example, I shared a flight from Los Angeles to New York once with a guy who sold solar panels. He was German, and his big area of selling solar panels was San Diego, Los Angeles, and Las mm-hmm. Vegas. But he told me that his company would not survive if the German government wasn't giving it a lot of money to keep it afloat, that they could not sell the solar panels at a competitive price unless they were subsidized by the German government.
I think that's a kind of historical situation. The world is not, in a sense, ready to buy solar panels like you buy milk and eggs at the grocery store. But increasingly, they're becoming, like so many other green products, and I'm always a little worried about using that term or hesitant, increasingly competing in the marketplace on the terms of the market as it's always been. And when that happens, then the German government and others that are subsidizing the development of these new technologies and helping introduce them to the market, those subsidies are, I believe, just going to disappear.
Well, not until the solar panels become more efficient, because that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Well, when they become more efficient, then we don't need any kind of intervention because they'll compete for a power by cost alone. But the externality, the benefit that the homeowner doesn't get, that is that's the reduction in carbon dioxide, that's a social benefit. The governments pay for that in terms of kind of giving it away to everybody.
We just saw a thing in today's Times about a growth in interest in this because solar panels are being stolen
yes.
off of people's roofs
I read that.
Sold on the internet.
They're ripping copper out of lawns. It's craziness.
A listener says, if consumers don't buy enough junk, each quarter the economy begins to sputter. How would you address that?
I'm not sure I understand what he's saying.
I guess he's saying that junk is what keeps the economy afloat.
If he's talking about junk, meaning sort of iPods, computers.
Whatever, sure. Not junk
well,
bonds.
That's true. That's the model. The model that drives our basic policy is that you got to grow. Neoclassic economics is one of the fundamental principles is that it grows, and if it doesn't grow, it's going to die. It just can't stay the same.
So I guess, as we said earlier, one of the solutions is to convince them to produce junk that doesn't destroy the environment.
Well, that's...
And is that happening in Europe? You seem to be hinting at that. Is Europe really doing all that much more? Other than two-button toilets helping the solar panel industry to keep afloat?
Yeah, I would say Europe's ahead of us. I'm not going to hold them up as an ideal model, but these issues are taken more seriously there. as I said earlier, the precautionary principle is now codified in the European Union's laws. There are many more schools of industrial design in Europe. They have always been there historically, and I have had a privilege of participating in a number of them, and they're focusing on the design for sustainability. You do see this in the U.S., but it's much less frequent.
You say that sustainability and happiness are related. How?
Well, I think that I talk about flourishing. I use it's a metaphor. It's a property that emerges when everything's going well. Happiness
could be called a bubble, as we've seen again and again in the economy. Is there a difference between flourishing and a bubble?
I don't think they're at all the same thing. I think that when things are going right, people flourish. And going right means lots of things come together. It isn't just having more money this month than the last month. It means your relationships with family, with friends, with jobs, with whatever makes you a human being are all working. Then flourishing comes forth. Happiness, another metaphor. I tend to use flourishing because happiness has become, I'd say, diminished by tying it much too closely with wealth, with economic measures. But they're the same kind of term.
My guest is John Ehrenfeld. His book, Sustainability by Design, is published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You seem to be a bit ambivalent about technology's role in sustainability. Can technology be a positive force?
Well, I think when technology carries the right values.
And but you say it erodes dignity.
The technology as it's designed, technology that is not understandable. The classic case is the jokes about VCRs that you can't, you just can't program a VCR. Well, if I watch this in my family, and I would say that it's true. I've seen my wife lose some dignity because it's a device that is every day. You want to use it, and it stymies you. It doesn't have to. Devices can be designed to interact with users to make them feel better, to have better values. Again, the two-button toilet is the kind of technology that instills the kind of values that are going to support sustainability.
Are solar panels, windmills, hydroelectric generators examples of flawed technology?
No, because they're basically production systems. They don't interact with consumers. You put a solar panel on your house, it provides heat, maybe provides some electricity, and you use that heat and that electricity to provide comfort and other things. So you don't interact with them the same way you interact with a toilet or an automobile.
So the solar panel allows you to be stymied by your VCR.
That's right. Very good.
What about nuclear energy? Do you see that as a positive technology? Because many people right now, in fact, one of the presidential candidates has been touting it, and the other one, I think, has backtracked a bit on it.
Well, I think that's a question that has to really take a whole segment on your program to really probe. I think it's increasingly likely that nuclear energy is going to be like business, a fact, and we're going to have to look at it seriously. And my guess is begin to redevelop the nuclear industry. I was at a conference, scientific conference this summer, spent a whole day talking about biofuels. And by the end of the day, this is a group who's very supportive. This is an environmental organization. By the end of the day, the 1,000-pound gorilla emerged in the room. Can't do it. And the only alternative to fossil fuels other than biofuels that's realistic is nuclear. So it's looming as a fact, as a necessity. It's the
but preferred, even biofuels as are being developed in Brazil, where they have a lot of sugar, and I mean, in this country, it seems that corn is the least efficient medium for developing a biofuel.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but biofuels locally, regionally, like in Brazil, can be an important factor. But biofuels coming out of the U.S. agriculture economy really don't make much sense.
One of the biggest discussions in the presidential race now is energy independence. Do you think that's achievable under present circumstances?
Well, again, you're stretching my areas of expertise, and I
but it all is connected to what you're talking about here.
Not really. I talk about global. Sustainability is a global phenomenon. You know, the U.S. isn't going to be sustainable if the rest of the world isn't. Energy independence is absolutely runs counter to the idea that we're in a global system.
T-Boone Pickens.
Yes,
he is pushing for wind energy, but also encourages the opening of ANWR to drilling. There are a lot of people out there who feel that if you're opposed to that, and see it as detrimental to the ecosystem, you're being foolish.
Mixing two things up. I mean, drill, baby, drill is the epitome of a Band-Aid. Even the proponents admit that this is a quick fix, that if we drill in ANWR, the likelihood we'll get more oil out of that than it'll be a couple years' worth is very small. The energy independence is a security issue, different kind of issue, and I focus on the former, not the latter. I just don't know enough about security.
So you're saying all of that talk is about America doing it alone, and the real answer has to be a global one. That means getting China on board, getting India on board, getting the emerging nations on board, as well as the industrial nations.
Well, I'd say absolutely.
Wasn't Kyoto an attempt to do that? Nobody that was willing to sign it.
All of these have been attempts, and they're good, and they're important to take steps. And if they're not working, to step back and redesign where you're going.
What advice would you give the presidential candidates about formulating policies to help America or the world become more sustainable?
Should have an answer to that.
Well, both of them agree that global warming is a concern and have proposals for creating green jobs. You think that either would be receptive to your plan for cultural change to bring about sustainability?
I think all the proposals you mentioned are really very good. As I say, Band-Aids are okay and necessary, but when they become sort of blinding, then you've got to look at the dark side.
Go ahead.
Yes, I think presidents can do a great deal in waking people up. I think that
using the bully pulpit.
Yes, but speaking to the people, and it's an art that's become gradually lost. I would have great hopes that our next president would begin to stop the political expediency of proposing Band-Aids and would begin to help this country begin to face up to what I call its addiction.
And then what would we do? Let's say if you had total power and you could impose an alternative to the way we're doing things today.
What would we do? I'd create a whole lot of schools of industrial design and begin to teach people how to design technologies that have these different values that help us recover our sense of responsibility. I'd fire the Council of Economic Advisors, and I'd try to find a different kind of economics to base my policy. Those would be a couple of, I'd say, very important first steps.
John McCain has offered a lot of money to somebody who comes up with a fully operational electric car?
again, it's a great idea. We ought to be doing that. There's no excuse for the slow pace of introducing automobiles that are more gasoline energy efficient. But that's not going to solve the fossil fuel global warming problem. It's a step in the right direction. But as long as we build cities that demand people commute forever, we're not, we're taking one step in one direction and two steps backwards.
My guest is John Ehrenfeld, and his book, Sustainability by Design, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Leonard. My pleasure.